Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My topic tonight is citizenship, and my touchstone is Alexis de Tocqueville, a man whose work I've been thinking about for the last decade or so, along with a colleague of mine in the history department at Providence College. But let me begin with a word about this painting that's up here. The artist, Johann Adam Simon Ertl, was a German immigrant. He moved to the United States in 1849 when he was in his mid-20s. And in the 1850s, he worked on the artwork for the new United States Capitol building. Here's a nice kind of old yellowed photo of him. His artistic career was long. He lived in lots of different places, though he spent some formative years in Westerly, Rhode Island, which is close to where I live. Here's a few more of his paintings. Bottom left is the Union Scout, 1866. Upper left is going down to Gethsemane, Christian painting, 1898, towards the end of his life. And his most famous painting, at least in the 19th century, is on the right, entitled The Rock of Ages, the original Rock of Ages, currently held by Harvard University. But the painting I began with, this one, pulling down the statue of King George III in New York City, it's 1853, depicts an event that happened on July 9th, 1776. It's held by the New York Historical, New York's first museum, near Central Park in New York City. And that museum has developed a citizenship preparation course for immigrants that uses hands-on work with its collection. This is a part of that collection. This is the painting from the previous page, by the way. I don't know if you could see the statue that's being pulled down is a statue of King George on a horse. The tail of the actual statue is right here, actually, a fun fact. That painting is used, along with the other items in their museum, to develop a hands-on citizenship initiative. It's kind of remarkable, and it's being copied now across the United States for similar civics courses for those preparing for the citizenship exam. Now, though they don't speak this way, I like to think that the New York Historical, the museum that holds these objects, would agree with what I'm about to say. Here's lesson one for you this evening. Maintain a real relationship, extending across space and time with your country. Now, before I say something about this, let me read this passage from Tocqueville. And I'm not sure if those of you in the back can read it, but I'm just going to read straight through, so you should be all right. Here's Tocqueville. In democratic nations, new families are constantly springing from nothing, while others fall, and those who remain change their appearance. The fabric of time is forever being ripped, and vestiges of the generations disappear. People easily forget those who went before them and have no idea of those who will come after. The only people in whom anyone is interested are those closest to himself. Aristocracy linked all citizens together in a long chain from peasant to king. Democracy breaks the chain and severs the links. Now, this passage is an important instance, I think, important point about democracy more generally. Democracy tends to isolate us geographically and temporally. We focus on the present, forgetting the past, dismissing the future, and we focus on what's close to us, ignoring places that don't impact us on a daily basis, and then moving from place to place so frequently that it's hard for us to develop a deep relationship with any one place. Tocqueville believed that democracy was, among other things, a principle of frequent change. An aristocracy, the time of kings and nobles, a principle of stability. Love of a particular land, my particularly family tree, the community in which I was born and grew up and died. So here again is the first lesson. If you want to be a good democratic citizen, a person who will contribute to the stability and longevity of your democratic community, you have to cultivate a stable and loving relationship with your community across time and space. Now, the New York Historical, that museum, offers one way of doing that. Following their path to citizenship requires developing a concrete relationship with objects fundamental to our country's history. But there's lots of other ways to do this, and here's a strange feature of democratic meritocracy over the last 100 years. We've steadily drawn talented young people away from the rural areas of their childhood and encouraged them to stay in cities, and preferably to move between cities as frequently as ambition might require. A stable democracy requires that a critical mass of citizens reject this tendency. In other words, if you want to be a good citizen, especially if you're an honors student, think about returning home after you graduate. Now, I think I've probably been a little unfair to all of you. How many of you know who Alexis de Tocqueville is? Okay, you do not count, Dr. Poulot. Well, that's about half of you. Have any of you read Democracy in America all the way through? Okay, three, not counting Dr. Poulot. So let me slow down then. Alexis de Tocqueville, here's a famous portrait of his from the middle of the 19th century. He was an aristocrat whose parents barely escaped execution during the French Revolution, a fate suffered by many of his family members, including, for example, his aunt's husband, Jean-Baptiste Chateaubriand, the older brother of the great romantic writer, some of you might have heard of him, and also Malesherbes, his mother's grandfather, and so Tocqueville's great-grandfather, who failed to defend King Louis XVI, during his revolutionary trial. Tocqueville was born in 1805, died relatively young, 1859, of tuberculosis. He was a writer and a statesman and played an important part in the French government, holding the position of Minister of Foreign Affairs for a brief time in 1849. He withdrew from politics in 1851 after the rise of Napoleon III, devoted the rest of his life to writing until his death at the age of 53. Now, let me say a little bit about some more specific parts of his life, and one in particular that I'm most interested in for tonight. He was born in Paris. He becomes a lawyer, trains as a lawyer in his young 20s, low 20s. And then he does something kind of unusual, although something that all young people would like to do, and that is to take a trip around the world paid for by someone else. He convinces, along with his friend, Gustave de Beaumont, but also a young lawyer, to be sponsored by the French government to inspect American prisons. American prisons at the time were experimental, sort of avant-garde, and there was real interest in seeing how Americans dealt with prison reform, prisons, punishment in general. And so he and his friend are sponsored. They arrive in the United States in May 9th of 1831. Tocqueville's just like 26, 25. And they spend 9 months here. They travel on this route. So they land in Newport, which is also Rhode Island. I'm a little offended Newport didn't make it onto this map. It just shows them landing right in New York City, which is a little insulting. But at any rate, New York, they meet most of the important American officials at the time, including President Andrew Jackson towards the end of their trip, although it was a very short visit, not a very productive one with that particular person. They start in New York after getting there from Rhode Island. They go north, as you can follow the little lines, through the Great Lakes, all the way to Green Bay. They come back and go north up to Montreal, Quebec, down to Boston, and then they travel south through Ohio, Kentucky, down the Mississippi River to New Orleans, back finally by land across to D.C., and then they sail home again for New York. When Tocqueville returns, about 3-4 years later, he publishes the first half of Democracy in America. For my money, the most important book ever written about democracy and the most important book ever written about America. It makes him instantly famous. He uses that fame to enter politics, becomes a member of the French Chamber of Deputies, kind of like going to Congress in 1839. 1840, he publishes the second volume of Democracy in America, which is not as well received as the first. Continues to serve in politics. There's a revolution in France in 1848, and he becomes a part of the community of politicians designing a new constitution for France. Then he resigns from French politics in 1851 when there's another revolution. Writes another amazing book, which I won't talk about this evening, The Old Regime and the French Revolution, and then dies in 1859. The last 20 years or so have seen quite a remarkable explosion of books and resources on Tocqueville. Alexis de Tocqueville has been a kind of rhythm in American history since he wrote Democracy in America. There have been different periods of great interest in his work, and then less interest, and then there'll be a revival of interest. The last 20 years have been a revival. The publication of many things that haven't yet been seen, publication of critical editions, new translations, and it's a great time to think about Tocqueville. And I think in particular, people are particularly interested right now because there's some anxiety about American democratic life in ways that there may not have been, at least in the same way, 20 or 30 years ago. The book I'm interested in tonight is this one, Democracy in America. It's his most well-known, as I said, published in two volumes, 1835 and 1840. It was written in French, but has been translated many times into English, of course, but also into many other languages. This particular edition is published by the Library of America. How many of you own at least one Library of America book? Now, that's not good. The rest of you, they're very inexpensive and high-quality editions of American literature. Very good. You all should know the Library of America and get at least a few used copies. They're worth having. This one is the only Library of America volume not originally written in English. It's a translation from French. Tocqueville famously claimed in writing Democracy in America, this is at the end of the introduction, he had no intention, this is Tocqueville now, he had no intention of serving or opposing any party. I did not try to look at things differently from the parties, but I did try to see further. They busy themselves with tomorrow only, while I aimed to think about the future. History has rewarded him, in part by leading both the left and the right to draw on the same book to defend their own particular political priorities. Let me be so bold as to claim that the lessons I hope to offer this evening, drawn from Tocqueville's work, though of course found elsewhere too, are likewise lessons for all democratic citizens, no matter our particular political convictions. Now, Democracy in America has a great deal to say about the foundations of the United States, the shape of our geography, the form of our laws, the nature of our customs. Most importantly for Tocqueville, more important than our unusual geography, full of resources and separated from European squabblings by a wide ocean. More important than our impressive legal framework, including, of course, the permanent tension between the autonomy of the states and the existence of a single union. Most important of all is our democratic customs, our mores, our habits of the heart, the notions we possess, the opinions current among us, the whole range of ideas that shape our habits of mind. What mattered more than geography and laws to Tocqueville was our mores, our whole moral and intellectual state as a people. Now, in democracy, the choices made by citizens, made by all of us, have a special weight. Indeed, Tocqueville thought democracy as a political form consists in an act of will on the part of every citizen, and therefore a project constantly in need of revitalization and of the strength provided by stable institutions. So, in a moment, I'll continue with my lessons on citizenship, but first, here's a principled foundation for these lessons, according to Tocqueville. Democracy is an achievement made possible by the repeated choices of its citizens. And for that reason, what we choose as citizens is profoundly important. Now, I don't actually mean the choices we make when we vote or when we sit on juries, although those choices are, of course, important. Instead, I mean the choices we make that form the foundation of our common life together, the framework, if you like, within which we work out our political differences. Maybe this gives a little bit of a different perspective then on lesson one, the one that I mentioned just a couple minutes ago. Here's one thing you have to choose kind of regularly. You have to choose to form a stable and long-term relationship with your political community. You can't always change. You have to, some in certain respects, regularly stay stable. How many of you know the author Wendell Berry or have read any of his novels? He's an interesting American writer. He's old now. He's in his 90s, I think, 95 maybe, something like that. His life is an attempt to create a fictional, stable, democratic community. His Port William novels. I recommend to you Hannah Coulter, for example, which is about 20 years old, 25 years old now. Quite a powerful book, written when he's in his 70s. It's a book about stability. It's trying to maintain freedom and nevertheless convince you to choose stability. Now, on to lesson two. I was grateful to read recently Chris Sarnate's book, Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. This is from 2019. Like Tocqueville, Arnade managed to draw praise from both the left and the right. You all probably, can anybody see who endorsed that book? J.D. Vance at the top. Yeah, it's 2019. I don't know how that would play today, but it was pretty great then. Arnade spent several years living in downtrodden communities across the country, befriending the poor and suffering, those who in one way or another are humiliated by our democratic meritocracy. Arnade took photographs wherever he went. Those pictures are half the substance of his book, and here's a bunch of them. He was asked once in an interview what dignity meant to him now that he'd finished what he set out to do. And he said the desire for dignity, he said, it's the desire to be treated like a normal human being. Now, here's how I think we should rephrase this, drawing on Tocqueville, but also for that matter on the long Aristotelian and Thomistic tradition of political theory. And those of you paying attention, I mentioned St. Thomas at least once so far this evening for the TI. I think democratic citizens should respect one another by showing a willingness to share in one another's lives and not merely one another's resources. Now, before I read the Tocqueville passage, here's a passage from Arnade's book. Here's Arnade. In their minds, the only places on the streets that regularly treat them like humans, that offer them a seat to sit in, an ear to listen, and really understand their past, are churches. They are everywhere. Small churches that have come in and taken over a space and light it up on Sundays and Wednesdays. They walk inside the church, immediately they meet people who get them. The preachers and the congregants inside may preach to them, even judge their past decisions, but they don't look down on them. They've walked the walk and know the shit they're going through, not from a book, not from a movie, not from an article, not from a study, but from their own life or the lives of their friends. Now, there's a deep connection here, I think, with something Tocqueville argued in Democracy in America. And this is a little bit of a long passage, but worth reading in full, I think. So here's the passage that I have up. In the United States, the most opulent citizens take great care not to isolate themselves from the people. On the contrary, they reach out to the people constantly, listen to them voluntarily, and speak with them daily. They know that the rich in democracies always have need of the poor, and that in democratic times, one wins the loyalty of the poor more through manners than through benefactions. Indeed, the very magnitude of the benefactions, which highlights the difference of conditions, secretly irritates those who profit from them. The rich do not at first grasp this truth. They readily consent to do good for the benefit of the people, but prefer to keep them scrupulously at a distance. They think of themselves in this way without kindling any warmth in the hearts of the people around them, because what is asked of them is not the sacrifice of their money, it is the sacrifice of their pride. Now, this is a striking claim, that somehow the essence of good democratic citizenship includes a special burden carried by the well-off. They must be willing to show respect to those without wealth. And showing respect involves more than simply doing good for them, benefactions. It principally involves treating them as equals. And this is done by showing that one is willing to share one's life with them. Now, here's one simple example. The wealthy need to be willing to have their children educated alongside the poor. Those of you interested in thinking about this very difficult recommendation, and it is difficult, should read a New York Times Magazine article, "Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City," also from 2019. It's written by the author of the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Whatever you might think of the 1619 Project, this particular article, deeply personal and also deeply thoughtful exploration of the opportunities and challenges faced by an upper-class family who wants to support the fabric of democratic society by participating in the education of children across class lines. The article has an ambivalent ending, and I've often wanted to know what happened to the family's experiment as time passed. Now, here's a more mundane example taken from a book by Robert Putnam. There's Robert Putnam. He's famous for a book called Bowling Alone, in which he studied the deteriorating fabric of associations that used to be so prominent in American culture. And hence the title, "We Still Go Bowling, But We're No Longer Part of a Bowling League or a Community." Do we still even go bowling? How many of you have bowled at least like 5 times? Okay, yeah, I mean, there he looks pretty glum and alone. There's the cover. I'm not sure we all still go bowling, but be that as it may. The example that I want to give, this is his most famous book, but my example is from another book called Our Kids, published in 2016. One of the things Putnam does in this book is travel to his hometown, Port Clinton. It's in Ohio, along the lake. It's the town he left, of course, for his education and eventually for his life at Harvard on the East Coast. And he remembers growing up with a rich kid in his class as one of his friends. That young man was sternly instructed by his family that when he was with his friends, who had less than he did, he lived like they did. In other words, instead of paying for his friends to eat at a fine restaurant, he ate what they could eat at the local diner. He lived with them as they lived. So, lesson 2, in a democracy, wealthier citizens must show respect to those less wealthy, and they do so not primarily by giving them from their wealth, but by mixing with them in ordinary day-to-day life, and living at least sometimes as they do. Now, for lesson 3, I'm going to come back to this image that Putnam used for the cover of Our Kids. I'm not totally sure why he used this image. It's like Halloween playground with the fog and everything. And so I really don't have anything to say about that. But it works well for me as a segue, because I want to talk about children and playgrounds for a few minutes. And to do that, I want to draw on what I think is the most extraordinary documentary ever produced, and that's the Up series. How many of you have heard of the Up series? I strongly recommend it to all of you. The UP series began in 1964 with 14 British 7-year-old children. The children were interviewed, footage was shot of them, their families, integrated into a documentary about an hour long about Britain's children and the future of their country. Then the production team returned to those same children every 7 years for another documentary until today. This is one of the children. She's in the middle of the photo, the woman. This is from, I think, 56 and up. She died of cancer before 63 up. This is all 14 children in the 70s, in the late 70s, when they're 21 years old. Now, the longtime director, Michael Apted, died recently, but the work's been continued, and 70 up is in production and will be released, we think, next year. Now, I recommend the whole series to all of you. I'm going to show you the final 2 minutes of the original 1964 documentary. At the end of the documentary, all 14 children are taken to a playground. And this is the very final, just under 2 minutes of the documentary.
At the end of their very special day in London, after their trip to the zoo and the party, we took our children to an adventure playground where they could do just what they liked. There is from a children's home set about building a house. Give me a child until he is 7, and I will give you the man. This has been a glimpse of Britain's future.
Okay, I'm really curious what you all think of that playground. Thumbs up from the back. Oh, another thumbs up. Anybody like, what's with the broken boards and the hammer? Yeah, so did you all catch the title of the playground? They referred to it as having a particular name. Adventure Playground. Yeah, it's really a great title. I'd like you to go play with some nails and broken splintery boards and tall poles and things. It's a technical word. So after World War II, there were many bombed out locations in Europe. I think in particular, this is a man in the Netherlands who discovered that children were playing in those spaces and that he was convinced it was good for them. And so a woman in Britain imported his ideas, gave it the title of an adventure playground, and they became a real thing. So how many of you would let your children play in one of those? Got like half the room. Oh, that was a delayed reaction, but I'll take it nonetheless, Dr. Pudlow. Okay, now just in case, this isn't crazy. So this is a video from 2019. And the volume, I'm going to try to fix the volume. It's a little bit different than the previous one. This is shorter, but this is from Vox online newspaper, a video about playgrounds. from 2019.
Chances are it looks something like this. There's usually a slide, a bridge, and a high point with a domed roof. That's what makes this a playground, and this, and this. But what about this? This isn't a junkyard. It's called an adventure playground. Here, there are no plastic play structures, just things like old tires, wood planks, and hammers and nails. Places like this represent one of the most debated ideas in play architecture, that playgrounds should be designed to let kids take more risks. Now, this nightmare for helicopter parents is the hottest new thing in American playgrounds, because there's growing evidence that play like this is a whole lot healthier and safer for kids.
Now, I'd love to debate that last claim, but let's move on for now. Now, it might seem that my example is more playful than serious, I think. But actually, I think the way we raise our children has profound and immediate political implications. I think Tocqueville would agree. Here's lesson three. Allow others to make bad choices. That is, one learns how to be free only by making risky choices, choices that matter, choices that can go wrong. And in a democracy, each citizen only learns how to make good choices by practicing choosing, and therefore also unavoidably by now and again choosing badly. Now, here's a passage from Tocqueville. I'm willing to concede, he says, that a remote and alien central authority might provide the villages and counties of the United States with an administration more efficient than that achieved by officials chosen from their midst. If required, I'm willing to grant that America would be more secure and that wiser and more judicious use would be made of its social resources if the administration of the whole country were concentrated in one person's hands. Yet I would still prefer the system of decentralization to its opposite because of the political advantages that the Americans derive from it. Now, it's easy to see how this might apply to raising children, but I think it's equally, if not more, applicable to the various layers of our broader society. Now, let me highlight three words here. So, more efficient. So my youngest child's 11. She has a 10-year-old friend. She's just a few months younger than my daughter. The 10-year-old is the oldest of five children, and she's responsible every morning for frying eggs for all of the kids. Now, her name's Edith, and Edith is about that tall, and she fries a bunch of eggs every morning. Now, I think at this point she's pretty good at it, but she's been doing it for a little while, and when she started, she probably wasn't that good. That is, it would have been more efficient for her parents to fry the eggs. It also would have been safer, that is, more secure. We have a gas stove. You know, they might have a gas stove. Do you want your 8-year-old frying eggs on a gas stove? It'd be more secure for an adult to do it. And it would even be, let's say, wiser, or... By that, Tocqueville means something like, well, it would fit into the context of the day better if an adult were doing it. The time it's done, how many eggs are done. So it could be more efficient, safer, and also more broadly fits best into the household, into the life of the household. But Tocqueville thinks it's better, all things considered, to tolerate the risk, the waste, and sometimes the problems with the larger picture, in order to make Edith the kind of person who's able to make good choices. Now, that's an example from childhood, but some of you might know the principle of subsidiarity, a principle of Catholic social thought, according to which decisions are left up to the person or community that's most immediately involved in them. Now, to test what you think about this, ask yourself whether some difficult political question, abortion, marriage, gender policies, gun control, pollution regulation, whatever it might be, ask yourself if that should be decided by the federal government or by the state governments or even more local bodies. That is, assume you could get the law you want at the federal level. Would it be worth it to forego this in favor of letting smaller political entities make their own decisions, even if that meant that at least sometimes the wrong decisions would be made? Tocqueville thought the answer was yes, since only then would we be able to learn how to make good decisions, and so how to successfully exercise and maintain our freedom. Now, by the way, a contemporary of Tolkien, St. John Henry Newman, and I'm going to mention him in my second mention of Aquinas. Newman's now the co-patron of Catholic education, quite kind of a remarkable thing, just declared a doctor of the church. He said something similar to this in 1838, right between the two volumes of Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Here's Newman. "We advance to the truth by experience of error. We succeed through failures. We know not how to do right except by having done wrong. We grope about by touch, not by sight, and so by a miserable experience exhaust the possible modes of acting till naught is left but truth. Such is the process by which we succeed. We walk to heaven backward." Now, on to my fourth lesson. Lesson four is also suggested in that short clip of the Adventure Playground from the first Up series documentary. At the very end, if you all remember, the narrator says simply, "Give me a child until he is seven and I'll give you the man." The narrator is repeating a phrase he spoke at the very beginning of the documentary, and the thought's clear. These 14 children, drawn from very different social backgrounds across England, they're already set upon a particular path of life. And by seeing them now and returning to them later, we'll see that we were right to think so. Now, Tocqueville thought something similar about nations. Famously, he spent a great deal of time in his book thinking about the New England towns of the 17th century, almost no time thinking about the American Revolution. He thought what really mattered was the beginning in the early colonies. And the Revolution was a kind of natural culmination of forces that had begun working long before. So here's lesson four. The beginning of a political community, like the beginning of an adult life, is crucial for the future. Here's Tocqueville. And again, this is a little long, but worth reading. "Examine the babe when still in its mother's arms. See the external world reflected for the first time in the still dark mirror of his intelligence. Contemplate the first models to make an impression on him. Listen to the words that first awaken his dormant powers of thought. Take note, finally, of the first battles he is obliged to fight. Only then will you understand where the prejudices, habits, and passions that will dominate his life come from. In a manner of speaking, the whole man already lies swaddled in his cradle. Something analogous happens with nations. Every people bears the mark of its origin, the circumstances that surround its birth and aid its development also influence the subsequent course of its existence. If we could trace societies back to their elements and examine the earliest records of their history, I have no doubt that we would discover the first cause of their prejudices, habits, and dominant passions, indeed of every aspect of what has been called the national character." So, my playground example, though not obviously political, was chosen on purpose. Democratic citizenship starts in childhood, just like national citizenship starts with a national founding. And my point here is not so much to talk about what should shape the lives of children, as it is that such shaping is crucial for democracy. Tocqueville expressed this by making the following simple an extraordinary claim. This is from Democracy in America. "If someone were to ask me what I think is primarily responsible for the singular prosperity and growing power of this people, I would answer that it is the superiority of their women." Tocqueville's reason for saying this was that it was women who shaped the mores of young children, and therefore the entire democracy hinged on the fact that women of talent and virtue shaped each coming generation of citizens from infancy. This matters a great deal to us today. We've been experimenting as a nation over the last 75 years or so with separating young children from both their parents for significant portions of the day. And Tocqueville would think it was a political and economic failure if a democratic society was unable to arrange social life so that young children need not be separated in that fashion. And it's striking, actually, that the trends in the United States have basically reversed since the year 2000. Not as quickly, but it's no longer a downward trajectory. It's now returning. The number of households, for example, with at least one stay-at-home parent has steadily increased since the year 2000. Now, as a country, we often speak as if education is the key to success. But one of Robert Putnam's findings from Our Kids, that book from a few minutes ago, is that schools are most of all echo chambers. They intensify other social factors like family structure, parenting style, community connections. That is, by first grade, children are already well on their way towards being the kind of citizens they will become. And of course, one more implication of that is that if Tocqueville's right, the democratic work of parents, most often still the work of women, who raise their young children deserves from our society far more honor and prestige, as well as economic consideration, than we currently grant. Now, I have one more lesson for you all from Tocqueville. So far, I've emphasized the fact that democracy is a political order in which citizens make daily choices that determine the long-term stability of their community. But Tocqueville also thought that the human spirit could only bear so much freedom of choice. Too much freedom would be overwhelming. And indeed, Tocqueville argued that human beings simply cannot maintain a situation of perfect freedom. Instead, human freedom is made possible within a framework of authoritative restriction. Now, one way of thinking helpfully about this has been given to us recently by R.R. Reno. He's the editor of First Things. This is one of the most important magazines about religion and culture today. And Reno's the editor. In 2019, I don't know why 2019 is such an important year for me this evening, but so it worked out. 2019, he published a book called Return of the Strong Gods. It's a book on those recent movements in the West, especially nationalism, that seem illiberal or counter to the dominant trajectory of greater and greater personal choice since World War II. The three most important strong gods, for Reno, are marriage, nationality, and religion. Each of those things restrict our freedom in fundamental ways, most importantly because they're things that we love, and so also things that we serve and that hold authority over us. Reno's book considers how, and also why, we're now seeing a return of devotion to those things that restrict freedom, that narrow our spheres of political action, and so that also emphasize authority. Tocqueville would not have been surprised. He was convinced we cannot maintain a kind of limitless, perfect freedom. Marriage for Tocqueville is one form of restriction, a fundamentally important one. But the most important restriction on human liberty, a restriction that actually makes possible political freedom itself, is religion for Tocqueville. Religion, for example, is there at the very beginning of the American founding, when the Puritans combined, according to Tocqueville, the spirit of religion with the spirit of liberty. Religion provided the early Americans with an authoritative moral tradition, and the stability and consistency of that tradition made possible wide and generous political freedom. Tocqueville was convinced that human nature can tolerate only so much instability, and political freedom is a principle of instability, change, the unpredictable. Here's my passage from Tocqueville. When no authority exists in matters of religion, any more than in political matters, men soon become frightened in the face of unlimited independence. With everything in a perpetual state of agitation, they become anxious and fatigued. With the world of the intellect in universal flux, they want everything in the material realm, at least, to be firm and stable. And unable to resume their former beliefs, they subject themselves to a master. For my part, I doubt that man can ever tolerate both complete religious independence and total political liberty. And I'm inclined to think that if he has no faith, he must serve. And if he is free, he must believe. Democratic citizens, thought Tocqueville, will only be able to sustain political liberty over the long term if they're also religious. That is, if they accept, in certain respects on authority, interconnected beliefs about morality, God, and the afterlife. In short, democratic freedom requires religious citizens. Now, most of what I've done in the last few minutes with you all is outline claims rather than defend them in a deep and sustained way. It would take much longer time to do that much harder thing, necessary though it may be. But I hope at least that I've given you some provocative and perhaps even compelling ways of thinking about democratic citizenship for us today from the perspective of Alexis de Tocqueville. I very much look forward to our discussion. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.